The presentation I'm about to make will not be simple. I ask your indulgence and attention as I walk you through case history and statutory elements. I promise to be brief, probably less than a half an hour, and direct. I will present the legal underpinnings of the law of obstruction of justice. You should have before you both the text of this speech, including the full citations to the cases, and copies of the charts that I will use in this presentation. I have Article 2 of the Articles of Impeachment alleges that the President prevented, obstructed, and impeded the administration of justice both personally and through his subordinates and agents, and that he did so as part of a pattern designed to delay, impede, cover up, and conceal the existence of evidence and testimony related to a federal civil rights action brought against him. Article 2 specifies 7 separate instances in which the President acted to obstruct justice. The House believes the evidence in this case proves that each of the 7 separate acts which comprise the President's scheme constitute obstruction of justice. I'd like to draw your attention at this time to the chart at my right and the first page in your packet, which depicts elements of Section 1503. Whoever corruptly influences, obstructs, or impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice shall be punished as provided in subsection B. The punishment for an offense under this section is imprisonment for not more than 10 years, a fine under this title, or both. Section 1503 is often referred to as the general obstruction statute. It describes obstruction simply as an impact on the due administration of justice. Section 1503 deems it criminal to use force or threats or to otherwise act corruptly in order to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice. Federal court rulings clarify that it is not necessary for the defendant to succeed in obstructing justice. Again, I direct your attention to the chart or the accompanying chart in your packet. Russell and Aguilar each ruled that it is not necessary that a defendant's endeavor succeed for him to have violated the law. Rather, simply attempting to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice violates the statute. Maggott clearly stated it is the endeavor to bring about the forbidden result and not the success in actually achieving the result that is forbidden. For the government to prove a Section 1503 crime, it must demonstrate that the defendant acted with intent. This can be shown through the use of force, threats by the defendant, or by simply showing that the defendant acted corruptly. The following chart gives 3 case histories regarding the term acting corruptly. Haldeman and Sprecher held that a defendant acts corruptly by having an intent or by having an evil or improper purpose and intent. Barfield defined acting corruptly as knowingly and intentionally acting in order to encourage obstruction. Sprecher also ruled that the government need not prove the actual intent of the defendant. Rather, the intent to act corruptly can be inferred from the proof that the defendant knew his corrupt actions would obstruct the justice being administered. Under Section 1503, the government must also prove that the defendant endeavored to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice. The statute is broadly applicable to all phases of judicial proceedings. Brenson described due administration of justice as providing a protective cloak over all judicial proceedings, regardless of the stage in which the improper activity occurs. Lundahl clarifies that Section 1503 is also intended to protect the discovery phase of a judicial proceeding, stating that the phrase due administration of justice is intended to provide a free and fair opportunity to every litigant in a case pending in the federal court to learn what he may learn concerning the material facts and to exercise his option to introduce testimony or such facts. The House believes that the facts of this case make it very clear that the President did corruptly impair the ability of a litigant in federal court to learn all of the facts that she was entitled to learn. In doing so, the President committed obstruction of justice under Section 1503. The other federal crime which the President committed was witness tampering under Section 1512 of Title 18. Again, I refer you to the chart on my right and to the second page in your packet, which depicts the elements of the section. Whoever knowingly corruptly persuades another person or attempts to do so or engages in misleading conduct toward another person with the intent to, one, influence, delay, or prevent the testimony of any person in an official proceeding, or two, cause or induce any person to withhold testimony or to withhold a document or an object from an official proceeding, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 10 years or both. Sections 1503 and 1512 differ in an important way. There does not need to be a case pending at the time the defendant acts to violate the law under Section 1512. The statute specifically states that for the purposes of this section, an official proceeding need not be pending or about to be instituted at the time of the offense for the crime to be committed. Putting it another way, a person may attempt to tamper with a witness and commit the crime of witness tampering before such a person is called as a witness and even before there is a case underway in which that person might be called to testify. For the government to prove the crime of witness tampering, it must prove that the defendant acted with the intent to cause one of several results. The defendant can be convicted if he acted to influence, delay, or prevent the testimony of any person in any official proceeding, or the defendant can be convicted if he acted to cause another person to withhold an object from an official proceeding. In the case before us, the evidence proves that the President endeavored to cause both of these results on several occasions. And the government may show intent on the part of the defendant in several ways. It may prove the use of intimidation, physical force, or threats, or it may prove intent by showing the use of corrupt persuasion or misleading conduct. In this case, the evidence shows that on several occasions the President acted corruptly to persuade some witnesses and engaged in misleading conduct toward others in order to influence their testimony and cause them to withhold evidence or give wrongful testimony. In each instance, the President violated the witness tampering statute. How does acting corruptly to persuade a witness differ from engaging in misleading conduct? Section 1515 of Title 18 states, as used in Section 1512, that's the witness tampering section, of this title and this section, the term misleading conduct means knowingly making a false statement or intentionally omitting information from a statement and thereby causing a portion of such statement to be misleading or intentionally concealing a material fact and thereby creating a false impression by such statement. Or with intent to mislead, knowingly submitting or inviting reliance on a writing or recording that is false, forged, altered, or otherwise lacking in authenticity. The difference then between corruptly persuading a witness and engaging in misleading conduct toward the witness depends on the witness's level of knowledge about the truth of the defendant's statement. Rudlitz held that misleading conduct involves a situation where a defendant tells a potential witness a false story as if the story were true, intending that the witness believe the story and testify to it before a grand jury. Let me clarify this detail. If a defendant simply asks a witness to lie, and the witness knows that he is being asked to lie, then the defendant is corruptly persuading the witness. In contrast, if a defendant lies to a witness hoping the witness will believe the story, and this is misleading conduct. They are different, but they are both criminal. Some may ask if it is necessary that the witness who is influenced or tampered with know that he or she might be called to testify. The answer is no. And both sections 1503 and 1512 answer this question. The witness tampering statute can be violated even if the victim has not been subpoenaed or listed as a potential witness in an ongoing proceeding. In Shannon, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit reviewed the conviction of a defendant under Section 1503 who had attempted to influence the testimony of a person who had not yet been subpoenaed or placed on a witness list. On appeal, the defendant argued that because the target of the obstruction had not yet become an official witness in the case, it was impossible for the defendant to have engaged in obstruction toward her. The Court of Appeals rejected that assertion. In affirming the conviction, the court held neither must the target be scheduled to testify at the time of the offense, nor must he or she actually give testimony at a later time. It is only necessary that there is a possibility that the target of the defendant's activities be called on to testify in an official proceeding. The witness tampering statute can be violated even when no case is pending. Therefore, it will not always be clear to whom the defendant intended the individual to testify, and the statute does not require proof of this. In Morrison, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia explained that Section 1512 is violated if the defendant asks a person to lie to anyone who asks. The court held that it is not necessary that the defendant even use the words testify or trial when he tries to influence the testimony of the other person. In such a case, there are no subpoenas, there are no witness lists. The mere attempt to influence the person to lie, if asked, is the crime. So under either Section 1503 or 1512, the fact that the target of a defendant's actions is not named as a witness or that the person is not ever called to be a witness is immaterial. The focus of both statutes is on what the defendant believed. If the defendant believes that it is possible that some person might someday be called to testify at some later proceeding and then acted to influence, delay, or prevent his or her testimony, the defendant commits the crime. Now, some have asserted that an obstruction of justice charge cannot or should not be made against the president because some of his acts occurred in the context of a civil trial. There's simply no merit to this view. There's no question that the obstruction and witness tampering statutes can be violated by acts that occur in civil proceedings. And case law is consistent in upholding that any attempt to influence, obstruct, or impede the due administration of justice in a civil proceeding violates Section 1503. Lundwall, which I referred to earlier, is a perfect example, as it began as a civil case. The actual language of the witness tampering statute makes it clear that it also applies to civil cases. The statute provides for enhanced penalties in criminal proceedings, a provision that would be unnecessary if the law were only to apply to criminal cases. In short, the fact that some instances of the president's misconduct occurred in the course of a civil proceeding does not absolve him of criminal liability. As Mr. Barr will demonstrate, the President of the United States endeavored and did obstruct justice and tamper with witnesses in violation of the law of the United States. On numerous occasions, he acted with an improper purpose, with an intent to interfere with the due administration of justice in the federal civil rights lawsuit filed by Paula Jones. President Clinton corruptly endeavored to persuade a witness to lie. In some cases, he succeeded. In every case, he violated the law. President Clinton engaged in misleading conduct in order to influence the testimony of witnesses in judicial proceedings. He succeeded. In each case, he violated the law. President Clinton acted with an improper purpose to persuade a person to withhold objects from a judicial proceeding in which that person was required to produce them. He succeeded, and in so doing, he violated the law. President Clinton made misleading statements for the purpose of deterring a litigant from further discovery that would lead to facts which the judge ordered relevant in a federal civil rights case. In so doing, he obstructed the due administration of justice, and in that case, and violated the law. Whether attempting to persuade a person to testify falsely, or to ignore court orders, or to produce objects, whether suggesting to an innocent person a false story in the hopes that he or she will repeat it in a judicial proceeding, or testifying falsely in the hopes of blocking another party's pursuit of the truth, all these acts obstruct justice. All these acts are federal felony crimes. All these acts were committed by William Jefferson Clinton. Thank you.
The chair recognizes the majority leader.
Mr. Chief Justice, I ask your time to consent that there now be a recess again of the proceedings for 15 minutes. Please return promptly to the chamber.
Without objection, it's so ordered. Senator will come to order. Chair recognizes the majority leader.
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe we're ready for the final segment for today. It will be presented by Mr. Manager Barr.
The chair recognizes Mr. Manager Barr.
Mr. Chief Justice, Senators, learned counsel for the President, and fellow managers, on behalf of the House of Representatives, I thank the Senate for the opportunity to appear today and to present this argument. The House, and I especially, greatly appreciate the time and effort the Senate has taken on this most important and notable matter. You have heard the facts summarized by my colleagues. They have described for you the law of perjury and the law of obstruction. I will discuss several of the specific instances in which William Jefferson Clinton violated these laws as set forth in the Articles of Impeachment presented to you. The process facing you as jurors of fitting the federal law of obstruction of justice and of witness tampering and of perjury into the facts of the case against President William Jefferson Clinton is not a case in which there is nor should be a great deal of difficulty. It is not a problem of fitting a round peg into a square hole. Quite the contrary. We have a case here, you have a case here for consideration in which the fit between fact and law is as precise as the finely tuned mechanism of a Swiss watch, or as seamless a process as the convergence and confluence of two great rivers, such as flow through many of the cities which you represent. The evidence that President William Jefferson Clinton committed perjury and obstruction of justice is overwhelming. These are pattern offenses. I beg your attention to the following exposition of facts and law, but before commencing, I would like to address three issues which have come up during the course of the proceedings and which I believe might be helpful for all of us to keep in mind as we proceed not only through today's final presentations, but tomorrow's and those made by, which will be made by learned counsel for the President. First, by way of background on the process, that is the process that brings us House managers to the well of this great body, the trial of the President of the United States of America. As has been indicated previously by one of my colleague House managers, and as everyone here knows full well, the responsibilities, the jurisdiction, and the process between the House of Representatives and the Senate is very different in all three of those respects. And therefore, while coming as no surprise to all of you and all of us in this room, but perhaps to some in America, the steps that each body takes and should take and must take are very different. Just as one example, one might ask why were no witnesses called in the House of Representatives? Valid question, deserves a valid answer. That valid answer can be found not simply in impeachment proceedings and the history thereof, but also in the day-in, day-out proceedings in our federal courts and in our state courts. It can be found in the difference between the body which has responsibility and jurisdiction for charging a crime and the jurisdiction and responsibility of the body that has responsibility for trying a crime or an alleged crime. The House of Representatives, though not in every respect like a grand jury, operates much more like a grand jury than a petit jury. As something akin to a grand jury, we had in mind, and I know you have in mind, being very mindful and knowledgeable about the difference in procedure between the House and the Senate on matters of impeachment, that frequently in court cases presented to federal grand juries, and I suspect similarly to state grand juries, the evidence to the grand jurors themselves is not presented through a long array, a repetitive array of witnesses themselves, witnesses, that is, with first-hand knowledge of each and every fact, which would then later be proved at the trial. Rather, it is the more standard procedure, certainly in federal courts, with which I am more familiar, for the government to present its case to the grand jury by way of summary witnesses, Normally, that would mean case agents that have been working with the assistant U.S. attorneys or with the U.S. attorney in gathering, evaluating the evidence that will eventually be brought to bear in the trial of the case. If one were to be a fly on the wall of a federal grand jury, one would see, normally, witnesses for the government that would come in and discuss the general parameters and the specific evidence of the case that they would present in court, frequently summarizing the actual evidence that would be presented in court by the witnesses themselves. That is the standard operating procedure. That is not to say that there is also not presented voluminous written evidence, documentary evidence. That is frequently the case as well. Nor is that to say that there are not from time to time cases presented to federal grand juries in which there are actual witnesses with firsthand knowledge. I simply make the point, of which we are all aware, but I think as we begin or in anticipation of your process of sifting through all of this procedure, all of this evidence, all of this law, to keep in mind that our job in the House, we approached necessarily, had to approach necessarily, very different from the way you approach your job as jurors, as triers of fact. We, in fact, presented to the House of Representatives through the work on our Judiciary Committee a large volume of evidence presented to us and through us to the House of Representatives as the charging body, not the trier of fact body, that's essentially summarized and discussed through the words, through the opinions of the independent counsel as akin to the chief investigative officer in a grand jury in federal district court, through the words of many expert witnesses, as it were, who placed all of that in context. We did not want to usurp your duty, your responsibility, given to you by the jurisdiction, by the Constitution, as the trier of fact. We are not that presumptuous. It is your responsibility, it is your solemn duty to be the trier of fact. That is very different from our solemn duty, which I believe the House performed admirably in essentially reaching the conclusion that there is probable cause to convict the president of perjury and obstruction of justice. And we did so in a way that is mindful and respectful of your responsibilities, that carried out our responsibilities, and that is familiar to citizens all across this land because it is essentially the same process that operates in federal courts, where you see also, as here, a very clear distinction between the body that charges the crime, the grand jury, and the body that tries the crime, that is the jury, in this case, the Senate of the United States of America. A second point that may very well come up, perhaps, in the presentation of the defense by the President's learned counsels, which, although very familiar to those of us, which there are many in this chamber with a legal background, but which I think also is important to keep in mind as you reflect on and later deliberate on the evidence itself in this case. And that is that there are indeed two types of evidence. And in virtually every case, whichever finds its way to a court of law and results in a trial, both types of evidence are found, used, considered, and form the basis legitimately for the eventual rendering of a decision by a jury. Those two types of evidence are direct and circumstantial. Frequently, and I know this from experience, actual experience, defense lawyers will attack the government's case. And one of the standard attacks that they level against the government's case is it is based on circumstantial evidence. You even hear that by the folks out there today, not in this room, that are saying, oh, all we're seeing is circumstantial evidence. And that is not as good as direct evidence. Now, to the layperson, unfamiliar with the ways of our laws, our courts, and the work of this great body, that may have some currency. It may have some surface appeal. They may say, well, that commentator was right. That White House spokesman was right. If all they're doing is talking about circumstantial evidence, they can't have a very strong case, because if they had a strong case, they'd have direct evidence. Well, the fact of the matter is, it is a principle of long and consistent standing in every federal court in our land, and I suspect every state court in our land, that, as directed by every federal judge to every federal jury taking evidence, circumstantial evidence is to be and shall not be afforded any less weight than direct evidence. And triers of fact are directed by judges in every case not to accord less weight to one type of evidence as opposed to the other. That is, in the words of one of my fellow managers, a smokescreen, a red herring. If somebody raises as a defense in a case, this case or other case, has committed and ought to be convicted on perjury and obstruction of justice, I would respectfully ask that you remember that under the law of impeachment, based on our Constitution, proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the President committed each and every element of one or more violations of provisions of the Federal Criminal Code has never been required to sustain a conviction in any prior impeachment trial in the Senate. However, and I can say confidently that I speak for all House managers, in relating to you our belief that the record and the law applicable to these two articles of impeachment clearly establishes that President William Jefferson Clinton did in fact violate several provisions of Title 18 of the United States Code, that is the criminal code, including perjury, obstruction, and tampering with witnesses. Now, at this point, a lawyer would say, a fortiori. I won't. But I will say at this point that it therefore goes without saying that there indeed exists, under every historical standard, every historical benchmark which this chamber has used, there is more than sufficient grounds on which you might base a conviction as to both articles. Beginning then, in looking at how the facts and the law, both of which you have heard through the words and exhibits of my colleagues and the evidence that you already have, let us look first at the submission of the false affidavit in the Jones case. We believe the evidence presented clearly establishes that on December 17th of 1997, the President encouraged a witness in a federal civil rights action brought against him, that witness being Monica Lewinsky, to execute a sworn affidavit in that proceeding, which he knew to be perjurious, false, and misleading. As other managers have outlined, Monica Lewinsky filed a sworn affidavit in the Jones case that denied the relationship between her and the President. That affidavit was false. Ms. Lewinsky testified under oath before the grand jury that the scheme to file this false affidavit was devised or hatched during a telephone conversation with the President on December 17, 1997, a call the President initiated to Ms. Lewinsky at 2 or 2:30 a.m., ostensibly to give her the bad news that Betty Curry's brother had been killed in a car accident. But apparently, since it consumed the vast majority of the time of that conversation, more importantly, for the president to tell Ms. Lewinsky her name was on the witness list filed in the Jones case, and to thereafter discuss during that conversation the president's suggestion to her she could file an affidavit in the Jones case in order, for the purpose of avoiding having to testify in that case. Not to cover up, but in order to avoid having to testify in an ongoing legal proceeding in United States District Court. She testified both she and the president understood from their conversation they would continue their pattern of covering up. She testified she knew that if she filed a truthful affidavit, the Jones lawyers would certainly have deposed her in that case. The testimony of Mr. Vernon Jordan confirms the president knew Ms. Lewinsky planned to file a false affidavit. He stated that based on his conversations with the president knew in advance that Ms. Lewinsky planned to execute an affidavit denying their relationship, and that he later informed the president Ms. Lewinsky had signed, in fact, that false affidavit. For his part, the president denies asking Ms. Lewinsky to execute a false affidavit. Instead, as he asserted in his response to the House Judiciary Committee's requests for admission, he seeks to have you now believe he sought simply to have Ms. Lewinsky execute an affidavit that would, quote, get her out of having to testify, close quote, while being factually correct. This statement reflects a legal impossibility. The president has admitted Ms. Lewinsky was the woman with whom he indeed had an improper intimate relationship while president. And he has admitted he was very concerned over the great personal embarrassment and humiliation he feared would have occurred if that relationship had been revealed in the Jones case. Yet, he would have you believe he cannot remember a call he made to that woman about that case, which occurred at 2 o'clock in the morning. His statement is not credible, and the reason it's not credible is because it's not true. As Mr. Jordan's grand jury testimony corroborates, the president knew what Ms. Lewinsky planned to allege in her affidavit, yet the president took no action to stop her from filing it. As you have heard in earlier presentations, the president's lawyer, Mr. Robert Bennett, stated in court directly to Judge Wright when he presented the false affidavit, quote, there is absolutely no sex of any kind in any manner, shape, or form, close quote, and that the president was, quote, fully aware of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit, close quote. The president took no action to correct his lawyer's misstatement. As you have also heard, the president in his grand jury testimony tried to disingenuously dissect the words of his attorney to remove his conduct from further examination, even though obviously and by any reasonable interpretation or inference of the definition given the president, his conduct with Ms. Lewinsky was covered. And he disavowed knowledge of his lawyer's misrepresentations by claiming he was not paying attention. That canard has been most ably disposed of in prior presentations, both through the words of the managers and the videotape presentations. Later in the deposition, when Mr. Bennett read to the president the portion of the affidavit in which Ms. Lewinsky denies their relationship and asked him, is this a true and accurate statement as far as you know it? The president answered, that is absolutely true. This statement is neither credible nor true. It is perjury. The inescapable conclusion from this evidence is that the president has lied and continues to lie about the affidavit. His continued false statements and denials about the affidavit bolster the conclusion of our managers that, in fact, he was part of a scheme to file the false affidavit. The evidence supports Ms. Lewinsky's account that such a scheme did, in fact, exist between them. The evidence and all reasonable inferences drawn therefrom do not support the president's denial. Inferences, I respectfully add, that in your deliberations, as in the deliberations of any jury, are to be and should be based on common sense and deliberated in terms of the light of your experiences in judging human behavior. Moreover, in engaging in this course of conduct, referring here to the words of the obstruction statute found at section 1503 of the Criminal Code, the president's actions constituted an endeavor to influence or impede the due administration of justice, in that he was attempting to prevent the plaintiff in the Jones case from having a free and fair opportunity to learn what she may learn concerning the material facts surrounding her claim. These acts by the president also constituted an endeavor to corruptly persuade another person with the intent to influence the testimony they might give in an official proceeding. Such are the elements of tampering with witnesses found at section 1512 of the Federal Criminal Code. Ms. Lewinsky knew full well her only hope of not having to testify was to file an affidavit that did not truthfully reflect her relationship with the president. The president also knew that if she had filed a true affidavit, without any doubt, it would have caused the Jones lawyers to seek her further testimony, something both co-conspirators desperately sought to avoid. In encouraging her to file an affidavit that would prevent her from having to testify, President Clinton was of necessity asking her to testify falsely in an official proceeding. He was attempting to prevent, and in fact did prevent, the plaintiff in that case from discovering facts which may have had a bearing on her claim against the president. His motive was improper, in the language of the law, that is, corrupt. And his actions did influence the testimony of Ms. Lewinsky as a witness in the pending official proceeding in U.S. District Court. Under both sections of the Federal Criminal Code, that is 1503, obstruction, and 1512, obstruction in the form of witness tampering, the president's conduct constituted a federal crime and satisfies the elements of those statutes. With regard to the issue of perjury before the grand jury concerning the affidavit, we as managers would show that when asked before the grand jury whether he had instructed Ms. Lewinsky to file a truthful affidavit, President Clinton testified, "Did I hope she'd be able to get out of testifying on an affidavit? Absolutely. Did I want her to execute a false affidavit? No, I did not." The evidence, however, clearly establishes that the president's statement constitutes perjury in violation of Section 1623 of the U.S. Federal Criminal Code, for the simple reason the only realistic way Ms. Lewinsky could get out of having to testify based on her affidavit would be to execute a false affidavit. There was no other way it could have happened. The president knew this. Ms. Lewinsky knew this. And the president's testimony on this point is perjury within the clear meaning of the federal perjury statute. It was willful, it was knowing, it was material, and it was false. Let us reflect and see also, members of the jury, how the use of cover stories and the development thereof ties in the facts and the law to constitute a basis on which you conviction on perjury and obstruction of justice. We as managers believe that the evidence presented to you also establishes that on December 17th, the president encouraged a witness in a federal civil rights action brought against him to give perjurious, false, and misleading testimony if and when called to testify personally in that proceeding. This was, in essence, the conspiracy, 18 U.S.C. 371, to commit both obstruction and perjury. Throughout their relationship, the president and Ms. Lewinsky understandably wished to keep it secret, and they took steps to do that, steps that ultimately turned out to be and constitute criminal acts. For some time, in fact, until Ms. Lewinsky testified under oath and under a grant of immunity, their efforts were remarkably successful, all things considered, all circumstances considered. Associates and employees testified in support of the president's stories, and even several Secret Service officers testified to the grand jury that they understood Ms. Lewinsky to be in the Oval Office to pick up papers. Yet, as Ms. Lewinsky testified, her White House job never required her to deliver papers or obtain the president's signature on any documents. It was all a sham. It was all a cover story. It was all a conspiracy to obstruct. Ms. Lewinsky testified later, after she left her White House job and went to the work of the Pentagon, that phase two of the cover-up went into effect. The two co-conspirators began to use Ms. Curry as a source of clearance into the White House. This was so even though the purpose of Ms. Lewinsky's visits were almost always to simply see the president. As my colleagues have told you, on December 17th, during that 2 a.m., or perhaps it was 2:30, telephone conversation placed by the president to Ms. Lewinsky, he told her her name appeared on the witness list in the Jones case. She testified that at some point in the conversation, the president told her, you know, you can always say you were coming to see Betty or that you were bringing me letters. Ms. Lewinsky testified that she understood this to be, quote, really a reminder of things that they had discussed before, close quote. She said it was instantly familiar to her. He knew, or I knew, she says, that is, Ms. Lewinsky knew, exactly what he meant. And so I respectfully submit to all of us here know exactly what the president meant. When the president then was questioned before the federal grand jury if he ever had said something like that to Ms. Lewinsky, he admitted that, well, I might have said that because I certainly didn't want this to come out if I could help it, and I was concerned about that. A cover story, which this was, between two teenagers trying to steal a date without their parents' knowledge is one thing. Such would not constitute a crime. It would be something we might even wink at, as long as it didn't happen too often. However, we are not here dealing with two love-struck teenagers trying to circumvent their parents' watchful eyes. We are dealing here with the President of the United States of America and a subservient employee concocting and implementing a scheme that, while perhaps not illegal in its inception, simply trying to keep a relationship private, did in fact deteriorate into illegality once it left the realm of private life and entered that of public obstruction. However, and this is critical in terms of establishing the illegality or convictability of the president's actions, the situation at the time of that early morning phone call from the president to Ms. Lewinsky was very different from that facing the president during any earlier discussions of a cover story. Now, in early December 1997, Ms. Lewinsky had been officially named as a witness in a pending judicial proceeding. She was now under an obligation to give complete and truthful testimony, and he, the president, was under a legal obligation at that time not to tamper with her or her possible testimony. This is precisely where private lies become public obstruction. This is, in fact, the bright line between childlike pranks and deadly serious obstruction of our legal system. The president and Ms. Lewinsky at that point entered the big leagues. And the president, a highly skilled lawyer, knew it, which is why he went to such lengths to continue the cover-up for so many months. The president knew that if Ms. Lewinsky were to testify, that she only brought papers to the president or to see the president's secretary, her testimony would have been neither complete nor truthful. Yet the president encouraged her to give that untruthful testimony. And in so doing, he broke the law of obstruction of justice, and in lying about it, he compounded the problem by breaking the law of perjury. As Mr. Cannon made clear, with regard to Section 1503, the General Federal Obstruction Statute of the Criminal Code, a person commits the crime of obstruction of justice when he attempts to influence the due administration of justice, which includes all aspects of any civil or criminal case, including pre-trial discovery. Mr. Clinton's encouragement to Ms. Lewinsky to tell something other than the truth certainly would have influenced the discovery process in the Jones case. Courts have consistently held that civil discovery is every bit a part of the due administration of justice protected by the obstruction statutes as any other aspect of any other civil or criminal case. And as Mr. Cannon also made clear, with regard to Section 1512 of the Federal Criminal Code, a person commits witness tampering when he attempts to influence another person to give false testimony in an official proceeding. Mr. Clinton did encourage Ms. Lewinsky to give false testimony about her reasons for being in the White House with the president. By encouraging her to lie, the president committed the crimes of obstruction of justice under Section 1503 and the crime of witness tampering under Section 1512 of the Federal Criminal Code. You have also, members of the Senate, heard about the president's statements to Mrs. Curry on January 18th and then again on the 20th or 21st. The president spoke with her in what was clearly, demonstrably, unavoidably, another potential witness to be influenced in the civil rights case. The president did this in this case by relating to Mrs. Curry false and misleading accounts of events about that case as to which he was going to testify, had testified, and again, with the intent that his recitation of the so-called facts would, in fact, corruptly influence her testimony. As the managers have previously described to you, the evidence in this case shows that on that Saturday, January 17th, only 2.5 hours after the president had been deposed in the Jones case, he called his secretary at home and asked her to come to the White House the next day, a Sunday. She testified, Ms. Curry, that is, testified this was very unusual. It was rare for the president to call and ask her to come in on a weekend. But of course she did. The next day, Sunday, January 18, 1998, at about 5 p.m., she testified to the grand jury that during her meeting with the president, he said to her, "There are several things you may want to know." He then proceeded to ask her a number of questions in succession. "You were presented evidence of these five statements by other managers. I will only emphasize that it was at that time and in that way, in that manner, that the president led Mrs. Curry through a series of statements and determinate questions to establish a set of facts describing his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky at the White House that supported his false testimony. As you have heard, Ms. Curry stated under oath, she indicated her agreement with each of the president's statements, even though she knew that the president and Ms. Lewinsky had in fact been alone in the Oval Office and in the president's study. Prosecutors frequently see this pattern. It's not unknown to prosecutors, federal or state. You frequently see this pattern of agreeing to things that the person knows are not true, where you have a dominant person suggesting testimony to another person who is in a subordinate relationship. This, I submit, is yet another bright line between a private lie and public obstruction. During the president's grand jury testimony, he was asked about his statements to Mrs. Curry. He testified he was trying to determine whether his recollection was accurate. As he put it, "I was trying to get the facts down. I was trying to understand what the facts were." This fits the same pattern of a classic obstruction prosecution in which a defendant suggests a story to someone in the hopes that they will later testify consistent with that earlier suggestion. Indeed, when defendants in federal courts defend against obstruction prosecutions in those type cases, they frequently rely on the very same defense the president raises here, that he was merely and oh so innocently encouraging the other person to tell the truth. You may want to see as an example of an unsuccessful effort at such a defense in the case of United States v. O'Keefe, a Fifth Circuit case from 1983. In that case, Mr. O'Keefe did not ask someone to lie. He did not even say, "I suggest you lie." Rather, as is almost always the case in white-collar obstruction prosecutions, his words, along with their setting and their context, suggested a certain story, in that case as well as this, a false story. Just as Mr. O'Keefe did not expressly ask someone to lie, Mr. Clinton never asked someone to lie. He didn't have to. He was too smart for that. And he had witnesses who, at that time at least, were willing, ready, and able to do his bidding. The president lied to the grand jury when he made these statements, mischaracterizing his earlier statements to Mrs. Curry, just as he tampered with her as a likely witness 9 months earlier in January. The president's assertion that he simply was trying to understand what the facts were lacks even colorable credibility when one considers that he had already testified. It was obviously too late to try and recollect what the facts were. If, in fact, one accepts that, then he's admitting he didn't testify to what the facts were under oath at the deposition. Because he didn't say, "I don't know, I have to ask Mrs. Curry." He testified under oath as to what the facts purportedly were. Then he would have us believe that he had to, after the fact of the deposition, go back and find out what the facts were from somebody else. That is an argument that cannot be made with a straight face. In any event, Mrs. Curry could not have told him what the true facts were because he alone knew what they were. The defenses and explanations the president's defenders raised to justify why the president would make factual assertions to Mrs. Curry about the circumstances of his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky right after his testimony are many. For example, one administration witness who appeared before the House Judiciary Committee actually suggested that such coaching is proper as a method whereby an attorney prepares a client or witness for testimony. Of course, such a suggestion in this case would be ludicrous. President Clinton obviously did not and could not represent Mrs. Curry as her attorney. Yet it is this sort of explanation, straining credulity, that illustrates the lengths to which the president's defenders have gone to try and explain away the obvious, that there was no legitimate reason why the president made the statements to Mrs. Curry after his grand jury testimony other than to suggest to her what her testimony should be. In federal criminal trials, defendants go to jail for such obstruction. In the case before you, we submit this clearly forms a proper basis on which to convict this president of obstruction of justice for witness tampering and subsequent perjury. Please keep in mind also, it is not required that the target of a defendant's actions actually testify falsely. In fact, the witness tampering statute can be violated even when there is no proceeding pending at the time the defendant acts in suggesting testimony. As the cases discussed by Manager Cannon demonstrate, for a conviction under either Section 1503, obstruction, or 1512, obstruction by witness tampering, it is necessary only to show it was possible the target of the defendant's actions might be called as a witness. That element has been more than met under the facts of this case. It was not only likely Mrs. Curry would be called, the president's own testimony, deliberate testimony to the grand jury, pretty much guaranteed that she would be called. He wanted her called so that she could then buttress his false testimony. His actions clearly, we believe, violated both the general obstruction statute and the witness tampering statute in these particulars and in this regard. With regard to the obstruction regarding the subpoena for the president's gifts to Ms. Lewinsky, let us look at the merger of the facts and the law. As has been discussed, while the witness tampering statute makes it a crime to attempt to influence the testimony of a person, it also makes it a crime to influence a person to withhold an object from an official proceeding. In other words, to tamper with evidence. The facts of this case, we as House managers believe, clearly show the president corruptly engaged in, encouraged, or supported a scheme with Monica Lewinsky and possibly others to conceal evidence that had been subpoenaed lawfully in the Jones case. On December 19th of 1997, Ms. Lewinsky was served with a subpoena in the Jones case, requiring her to produce each and every gift given to her by the president. Then on December 28th, Ms. Lewinsky again met with the president in the Oval Office, at which time they exchanged gifts. They also discussed the fact that the lawyers in the Jones case had subpoenaed all the president's gifts to Ms. Lewinsky, and especially a hat pin. The hat pin apparently had sentimental significance to both of them in that it was the very first gift the president gave to Ms. Lewinsky. During that conversation, Ms. Lewinsky asked the president whether she should put the gifts away outside her house or give them to someone, maybe Betty. At that time, according to Ms. Lewinsky's sworn testimony, the president responded, "Let me think about that." Well, apparently he did. Because later that day, that very same day, only a few hours after Ms. Lewinsky and the president had met to discuss what to do with the gifts, Ms. Curry called Ms. Lewinsky, setting in motion the great gift exchange. According to Ms. Lewinsky, Mrs. Curry said, "I understand that you have something to give me." Or, "The president said you have something to give me." In her earlier proffer, or offer of evidence to the independent counsel, prior to her testimony before the grand jury, Ms. Lewinsky said, Mrs. Curry had said the president had told her, that is Mrs. Curry, that Ms. Lewinsky wanted her to hold on to something for her. After their conversation at the Oval Office, Mrs. Curry drove to Ms. Lewinsky's apartment for only the second time in her life. There, she picked up a box sealed with tape and on which was written, "Please do not throw away." Mrs. Curry then took the box, drove to her home, placed the box under her bed. Now, at her grand jury testimony, Mrs. Curry testified that she and Ms. Lewinsky did not discuss the content of the box, nor did she open it once she got it to her home. But she knew, she understood what was in the box, that it contained the gifts from the president to Ms. Lewinsky. In fact, Ms. Lewinsky testified Mrs. Curry was not at all confused, surprised, or even interested when she handed the box over to her. The legal import of this is that there is no question that if the gifts had actually been produced to the Jones lawyers, they would have established a significant relationship between the president and Ms. Lewinsky. Knowledge of the gifts, at a minimum, would have caused the Jones lawyers to inquire further as to the nature of the relationship between the president and Ms. Lewinsky. Her failure to turn over the gifts, as required by the lawful subpoena served on her, was, in the words of the witness tampering statute, the withholding of an object from an official proceeding. We believe the evidence shows, clearly establishes, that the president corruptly persuaded Ms. Lewinsky to withhold these objects from the lawful proceedings in the Jones case. In his grand jury testimony, the president asserted he encouraged Ms. Lewinsky to turn over the gifts. Ms. Lewinsky's testimony directly contradicts that. Importantly, all other evidence of subsequent acts corroborates her testimony, not the president's. For one thing, the gifts were never turned over. In fact, Ms. Lewinsky testified she was never under any impression from anything the president said that she should turn over the gifts to the attorneys for Ms. Jones. Quite the opposite. While the president asserts he never spoke about this matter with Betty Curry, he would have us believe that his personal and confidential secretary would, on a Sunday, drive to the home of the woman with whom he was having an inappropriate intimate relationship, take possession of a sealed box which she believed to contain gifts given by the president, hide the box under the bed in her home, never question the person giving her the box, and never even mention to the president she had received the box of gifts. The president's position, as he would have you believe, is not credible. It defies the evidence. It defies any reasonable interpretation or inference from the evidence. It defies common sense, and it stands in defiance of federal law. The only reasonable interpretation of the facts is that, following the discussion between the president and Ms. Lewinsky earlier in the day on December 28, the president decided Ms. Lewinsky had actually come up with a pretty good suggestion. The gifts should be put away outside of her home. As jurors, you may reasonably presume that based on the evidence and all reasonable inferences therefrom, along with common sense, that it was the president who directed Mrs. Curry to call Ms. Lewinsky to tell her she understood she had something for her, and that happened to be evidence under lawful subpoena in a civil proceeding in U.S. District Court.